From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Kris Kristofferson has just turned 70. On today's Fresh Air, he'll tell us about writing some of his best-known songs, like Me and Bobby McGee and Why Me. He's got a new CD of original songs, and there's an upcoming tribute album. Also, how Sergio Leone revived the Western, made a star of Clint Eastwood, and created his own visual style. We talk with Christopher Frayling. He's the chair of the Arts Council of England and an expert on spaghetti Westerns. And I'll preview two new TV offerings. Broken Trail is a new Western starring Robert Duvall, and Bill Moyers has a new talk show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Chris Christopherson, just turned 70. But the summer of 2006 is turning out to be a very busy period for him. Last week, he was honored with the Johnny Mercer Award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Next month, he'll get his hands in cement at the Hollywood Walk of Fame. There's a new tribute album, The Pilgrim, a celebration of Chris Christopherson, with other artists performing his songs. And Christopherson himself has a new studio album out called This Old Road.
Am I young enough to believe in revolution? Am I strong enough to get down on my knees and pray? And am I high enough on the chain of evolution to respect myself and my brother and my sister and perfect myself in my own peculiar way? I get lazy and forget my obligations. I'd go crazy if I paid attention all the time. And I want justice, but I'll settle for some mercy on this holy road through the universal mind. Am I young enough to believe in revolution?
Christopherson entered the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2004 for writing such songs, some of them crossover hits, as Me and Bobby McGee, For the Good Times, From the Bottle to the Bottom, and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Christopherson arrived in Nashville in the 60s, after living in England as a Rhodes Scholar and serving in the military. His first job in the music industry was working as a janitor at Columbia Records. It was there that he met Johnny Cash, who became his good friend, recorded Christopherson's songs, and convinced Christopherson to start recording himself. Christopherson is as well known for his acting as his singing. His films include Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, A Star is Born, Lone Star, Payback, and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Terry spoke with Chris Christopherson in 1999. Let's get started with his best-known song, Me and Bobby McGee.
If it sounds country, man, that's what it is. It's a country song. Yeah, okay.
Where? One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Busted flat in Baton Rouge and heading for the trains, feeling nearly faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained, took us all away to New Orleans. I took my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana and was blowing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time and Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a velvet song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
The most famous line from the song is freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. What inspired that line?
Well, that's what the song was really about to me, was the double-edged sword, you know, that freedom is. And when I wrote that, some of my songwriter friends in Nashville told me to take it out of the song, said it was that it didn't fit, that the rest of the imagery was so real and concrete that it was out of place to put a little philosophical line in there.
Tell me if I remember correctly, did you have a house that burned down at about the time you wrote the song?
No, No, I had had. I tell you what, I had. I was living in a condemned building at the time, and in a thing it cost me, I think, $50 a month, and somebody had broken into it during the week that I was down in the Gulf of Mexico, and trashed the place and stole what little I had to steal. I remember it was a very liberating feeling to me because everything was gone, and there was nowhere to go but up. I had also alienated my family at the time. My wife had left me, and I was separated, from my kids. And I think I'd been disowned by my parents by that time, and it was pretty liberating not having any expectations or anything to live up to.
How did Janis Joplin end up recording this song?
Bobby Neuwirth taught Janis the song, I believe, and I think he'd heard it when Roger Miller had recorded it. Mm-hmm. I first heard that she had sung this song when I came back from, I'd been down in Peru making a movie with Dennis Hopper, singing Bobby McGee, as a matter of fact, in the film. And somebody told me she had sung it in a concert, I think it was in Nashville. And then later, Bobby introduced me to her, and we lived out of her house for about a month or so. And we became close friends, but I never did hear her sing it. I never heard her tape of it till the day after she died. Hmm. Paul Rothschild played it for me.
What year did you first get to Nashville, and what was it like when you got there?
I first went there in June of 1965, and was on my way back from a 3-year tour in the Army in Germany, and was on my way to the career course down at Fort Benning, and from there to supposedly to teach English at literature at West Point. And since my military obligation was already fulfilled, I decided I was going to get out of the Army and be a songwriter. I had spent a couple weeks there just on tour. I mean, just, I was on leave, and got shown around to some of the songwriter sessions and got a glimpse of the life. I've always felt like I was really lucky to have been exposed to Nashville at that time, because I'm sure it's different now.
Kris Kristofferson speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His new CD is called This Old Road. There's also a tribute CD featuring other country artists doing his songs called The Pilgrim. Here's Willie Nelson singing Kristofferson's song, The Legend.
Was it better then, with our backs against the wall? Were we better men than we'd ever been before? Say, if she came again today, would you still answer to the call? Tell the truth, my friend, don't it matter anymore? We were simple men by her side when she was born. was simple then. Like the freedom when you fall. And we were smaller than you see, but soon we gathered like a...
We'll continue our interview with Kris Kristofferson after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1999 interview with Kris Kristofferson. His new CD is called This Old Road.
How did you start making movies? Did you think, one day I'm going to act?
When I started performing my own songs, my first the first place I ever played was at the Troubadour Club in Los Angeles. It was kind of a hangout like the Bitter End in New York. And... I think at the time there was more people looking for new blood, because I got a lot of offers just off of performing there. And eventually Harry Dean Stanton gave me a script. I didn't even know he was an actor at the time. I thought he just sang in the bar there at the Troubadour. But he helped me do a screen test for a film that was called Cisco Pike. And I got to put my music in it. And I was the lead in a film with Gene Hackman and Karen Black and Harry Dean. And it just went on from there.
Compare the roles that you get now with what you got early on. You're often playing the heavy now.
Yeah, I think that's thanks to John Sayles.
And Lone Star.
In Lone Star, yeah.
Yeah, where you played a sadistic sheriff.
Yeah, it was so different from most of the roles that I played before that I think people finally thought I was acting. I'm not sure anybody thought I'd ever acted before that.
Well, I thought I'd play a short scene from Payback. And in this movie, Mel Gibson is a con man who's getting revenge on the people who conned him out of $70,000 and also shot him and left him for dead. You play somebody who heads a crime syndicate, and Mel Gibson has kidnapped your son and is holding him hostage until you deliver the $70,000. But now you've got Mel Gibson tied up, and you're trying to get him to tell you where he's holding your son. And here you are threatening him.
Here it is. 130,000. That's as close as you're ever going to get to it. But I'll make you a deal. Tell me where John is and I'll finish you quick. I promise you won't have to find out what your left ball tastes like. But if there's even a bruise on him, I'll make this last 3 weeks. I'll give you a blood transfusion to keep you alive if I have to. Where is he?
That's Kris Kristofferson in a scene from Payback. How'd you get this part?
Well, they had actually finished the film and apparently weren't satisfied with the way it worked. And they created this character for me to play. And I went in and shot a week, and I told Mel, I said, yeah, there's not any pressure on me. The whole film doesn't work, and you're expecting me to repair it in a week. But I think I got it because of playing Charlie Wade, you know, in the Lone Star.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine it's a lot of fun to be in a movie like this in which there's a lot of really good, snappy, hard-boiled writing. It's a really well-written and directed film.
Yeah.
It also must be fun to be terrorizing Mel Gibson.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was so late at night when we did that. I my brain sort of locked up there for a while, and I can remember he was sitting. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and he was sitting there. It was painfully in the chair while the guy was smashing his toes with a hammer, you know, and I sort of just. My brain was paralyzed for a moment there. I said, you know, this usually happens to me about once in every film. I get to a point where I just can't imagine that I'll ever act in anything again, that I find myself uniquely unequipped to be an actor. I says, but usually it takes longer to get to it than this. This was my first night.
Did people panic when you said that?
Not really. I don't think anybody was afraid that I couldn't do it.
Well, I'd like to close with another song from the Austin Sessions. And this is a song called The Pilgrim, Chapter 33. Now, this song is quoted in Taxi Driver. The Sybil Shepherd character, Betsy, buys the record for Travis, the taxi driver played by Robert De Niro, and she says that he reminds her of the character in the song, and she quotes the line, he's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction. How did the song end up in Taxi Driver?
I don't know. I always felt like that was the nicest thing that Marty Scorsese ever did to me.
I guess you had already worked with him, and Alice doesn't live here anymore.
Yeah, but I didn't know it was going to be in that one. And God, he had, there's De Niro holding up my album, and they're quoting me like Bob Dylan or something. It was, I still think that's one of the sweetest things I've ever seen anybody do for anybody in the business.
And who did you write the song about?
Well, I wrote it about myself and about a lot of friends of mine that I thought were, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Chris Gantry, Johnny Cash, and everybody I knew at the time. And a lot of us were 33 at the time. That's why it's called Chapter 33. And Dennis Hopper. I remember when we were down in Peru, every time that you would tell somebody you were 33 years old, they'd say, oh, the age of Christ. So that sort of fit the pattern of it.
So were you referring at all to how you and a lot of people you knew were kind of self-invented?
Oh, yes. Yes. Partly truth and partly fiction. You know, I've always felt that I and many of the people I admire are figments of our own imagination. I always felt that Willie Nelson, Muhammad Ali, were particularly successful at that, at imagining themselves and living up to what they imagined themselves to be. When I first saw Muhammad Ali, he was Cassius Clay. He was a little skinny, light heavyweight over in Rome. And he was telling everybody he was going to be the biggest, the best. You know, he was the next Joe Louis, and he imagined himself right up into that.
Do you feel you did that too?
I think I did. When I think back to when I first was writing my first songs, you know, like when I was 11 years old, down in Brownsville, Texas, I think that I imagined myself into a pretty full life after that. I was certainly not equipped by God to be a football player, but I got to be one. And I got to be a ranger and a paratrooper and a helicopter pilot, you know, and a boxer. And a lot of things that I don't think I was built to do. I just imagined them.
Songwriter, singer, and actor Chris Christopherson speaking with Terry Gross. His new CD is called This Old Road, and the new tribute album featuring his songs is called The Pilgrim, a celebration of Kris Kristofferson. I'm David Bianculli, this is Fresh Air, and here's that scene from Taxi Driver.
You want to go to a movie with me?
I have to go back to work then.
Well, I don't mean now, I mean like another time, though.
Sure, you know what you remind me of?
What?
That song by Kris Kristofferson.
Who's that?
The songwriter. He's a prophet. He's a prophet and a pusher. Partly truth, partly fiction. Walking contradiction.
You saying that about me?
Well, who else would I be talking about?
I'm no pusher. I never have pushed.
No, no, just the part about the contradictions. You're that.
He's a poet. He's a picker. He's a prophet. He's a pusher. He's a pilgrim and a preacher and a problem when he's stoned. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction, taking ever wrong direction on his lonely way back home. He has tasted good and evil in your bedrooms and your bars, and he's traded in tomorrow for today, running from his devil's lord and reaching for the stars and losing all he loved along the way. But if this world keeps right on turning for the better or the worse, and all he ever gets is older and around.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. And from IFC Films and the Weinstein Company, presenting Wordplay, a look inside the crossword puzzle phenomenon with New York Times crossword editor Will Shortz and others. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Clint Eastwood became the man with no name. Christopher Frayling tells us about the westerns of Sergio Leone. Also, I'll tell you about two new TV programs. And guess what? They're not reality shows. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. A fistful of dollars, for a few dollars more, the good, the bad, and the ugly, once upon a time in the West. The brutal West of Italian director Sergio Leone revived the genre, made a movie star of Clint Eastwood, created a visual style that influenced many film directors around the world, and introduced many of us to the film music of Ennio Morricone. Leone, who was born in 1929 and died in 1989, described himself as growing up in the cinema. Both his parents had worked in the movies. Leone's films in the 60s got little respect in their own time. They were disparagingly referred to as spaghetti westerns. In 2005, Terry spoke with Christopher Frayling, one of the world's leading experts on Sergio Leone. He's the chair of the Arts Council of England and rector at London's Royal College of Art. Last year, Frayling co-curated an exhibit called Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone, at the Autry National Center's Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. He also wrote a companion book of the same name. In April, Frayling came out with a new book called Spaghetti Westerns, Cowboys and Europeans from Carl May to Sergio Leone. Let's start with a clip from A Fistful of Dollars, which features the tough guy character Clint Eastwood developed in Leone's movies.
Adios, amigo. Listen, stranger. Didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
See, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you went and fired those shots at his feet.
Hey, you making some kind of joke?
No. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize... I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
Why did Sergio Leone love Westerns? Why did he want to make them in Italy?
Well, you've got to imagine a child growing up in 1930s Rome at a time when Mussolini was the dictator and when most American movies were banned and those that were seen were dubbed into Italian. And the young Leone first saw his Hollywood Western movies in the 1930s at that time, and his heroes were Gary Cooper and Clark Gable and films like Stagecoach. And to him, they represented an absolute model of freedom. He lived in suburban Rome in cramped conditions, and he saw these wide open spaces, this unimaginable desert that goes on forever. He saw these characters. He couldn't understand what they were saying. He never heard the. In fact, he never learned to speak English, Sergio Leone. That's what's so extraordinary. But they were dubbed into a different language, not very well. But nevertheless, they clicked in his mind. Then, in the 1950s, when he went into the film industry, he found that nobody was really very interested in the Western. A lot of Hollywood veteran directors went over to Italy to make epics, films like Ben-Hur and Helen of Troy and Quo Vadis. And Leone hung around these films. Sometimes he was the assistant director. And he talked to directors like Fred Zinnemann, who'd made High Noon, Robert Aldrich, who'd made The Last Sunset and Apache and films like that. And they all said to him, the Western's dead. It's finished. We don't make Westerns anymore. So basically, Leone made Westerns because Hollywood had stopped making them and because in Europe, and particularly in Italy, there was this huge interest in the Western and a huge knowledge of it as well. So the whole thing starts in a kind of folk memory of American Westerns that went back to the 1930s, and it's partly political. But the other thing was that Leone felt that Westerns had got a bit talky. There was too much talking in them. He liked Westerns where Rin Tin Tin did all the thinking, you know. Old-fashioned Westerns where lots and lots of action and not too much talk. He didn't like psychology. You know, Freudian Westerns got on his nerves. Films like The Left-Handed Gun with Paul Newman, where, you know, you feel if there'd been a social worker around, Billy the Kid would never have happened. Films like that, he didn't like. He liked films where, you know, a lot of shooting, a lot of riding, a lot of action, a lot of landscape. So he wanted to bring back the kind of innocence of the Western. It had become too sophisticated.
Well, you know, but he knew he was making Westerns that were different from American ones. Like he said, and I think this was to you that he said this in your interview with him, that John Ford, the great director of Westerns, was full of optimism, whereas I, on the contrary, am full of pessimism.
Well, that's the thing. he loved the look of the Western and the idea of the Western and the fairy tale of the Western, but he didn't like some of the ideologies. He didn't like John Wayne very much, and some of the sort of crusading element of the Western that you got in 50s and early 60s Westerns. So loved the visuals, didn't like the ideology very much. So he takes the concept of the Western and makes it much, much more cynical. I mean, the hero, for example, when people ask him, why are you doing this for us? As someone actually asks in A Fistful of Dollars, the first of his Westerns, why are you doing this for us? Instead of saying, you know, because a man's got to do what a man's got to do, or there's some things a man can't just ride around, things like that, that he says, $500? He works strictly for ready cash. So he has a very streetwise 1960s cash-only attitude to life. And this was a very different kind of hero, much more grown-up kind of hero to the old-fashioned crusading hero. And I think that the modern movie action hero begins with the Clint Eastwood character in A Fistful of Dollars, where you identify with the hero not because of what he believes in anymore, because he doesn't actually believe in anything. You identify with him because of his style, you know, the way he wears his clothes, the way he walks, the personal style of the man. And that, of course, is the basis of identification of all modern action heroes. And I think it begins with Clint Eastwood in A Fistful of Dollars.
Well, you know, in American Westerns, the good guys were usually, you know, relatively clean-looking and attractive in a movie star, you know, kind of way. In Leone movies, they're so violent. And everyone in it, you know, the bad guys and the guys who are relatively good guys, and nobody's exactly good guy in the American movie Western way, they're all, like, dirty, grizzled, and mean.
I know, it's true. And the production design, this sort of, the towns look very lived in. Leone couldn't bear those overlit towns you get in TV westerns. There were a lot, of course, in the 1950s and early 60s, there were lots and lots of TV westerns. In England, you know, every night on every channel, there was a different western series. And they were all very well scrubbed and well lit, and they looked as though they were shot on a back lot in Hollywood. And Leone detested that look. He wanted to, you know, dirty it up a bit, make it more grungy. So the towns look lived in, and the hats are all grey hats. They're not black hats or white hats, they're grey hats. Lots of dust, lots of designer stubble. Everyone looks as though they haven't washed for 3 weeks. And actually, if you look at archive photos of the historical West, I think his look was closer historically to what it was actually like to those Hollywood movies of the 50s and 60s. You know, everyone looks very kind of dirty, and they have bad teeth, and they haven't shaved, and their skin isn't, as you'd expect, isn't in very good condition. They didn't have access to healthcare. So in a funny way, he's doing quite a lot of historical research and looking at lots of archive photos. He had a vast collection of archive photos. And I've traced some of the visual influences and visual inspirations for his films in archive photos. So in a funny way, he's doing a lot of research, but it's kind of a well-researched dream, you could say. So he's creating a kind of dream world, a fairy tale world, but the surface of it looks very, very realistic.
Another convention that Leone breaks is, you know, you don't shoot children in cold blood in the great American Westerns. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yeah, you certainly are.
Yeah. And at the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West, the bad guys, and the lead bad guy is Henry Fonda, you know, Mr. American icon. The bad guys come in to this little deserted cabin in the desert, shoot up the whole family. One boy survives, and Henry Fonda looks at him, talks to him, and then shoots him in cold blood.
Yeah.
I don't think you would have seen that in an American movie, and you certainly wouldn't have seen Henry Fonda doing that.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, in American TV versions of Once Upon a Time in the West, that moment was cut, American TV audiences weren't ready for Henry Fonda doing such a dreadful thing, it was assumed at that time. I mean, the whole thing was that Leone loved casting against type. You know, he imagined that the audience had a memory in their heads of every performance that Henry Fonda had given. Here's the man who'd played young Mr. Lincoln, Frank James, he'd played Wyatt Earp, he'd played one of John Ford's heroes. This was the all-American hero. Who better to cast as a psychopathic, child-killing gunslinger? And Leone's great story was that Henry Fonda arrived on the set with brown contact lenses to cover his bright blue eyes and a dark stubble, because he thought bad guys had stubble and brown eyes. And Leone said, "You're missing the point." Or he said through his interpreter, "You're missing the point, Hank. The whole point is you've got to have those translucent blue eyes. You've got to be clean-shaven. And you make your first appearance, and the camera's just behind you at shoulder level. And it comes round to see you as you come out of the bushes, and your cheek is puffed out with a wad of tobacco. And the camera comes round to show your face, and I want everybody in the audience to say, 'Jesus Christ, it's Henry Fonda.'" And that's exactly what happened. Everyone is the last person in the world you'd expect in that situation. So partly a cinematic thing's going on, partly because in a Western universe where everyone's bad, there are some people who are very, very bad. In a Leone's universe, if you do nasty things to children, you are very, very bad. So the way to show the really bad guy, where everyone's wearing a grey hat, is that something horrible like the massacre of a family. Actually, there's quite a traditional morality underneath that. It's just that he's ratcheted up the odds a little bit more.
Christopher Frayling, speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Christopher Frayling, an expert on the Western films of Sergio Leone.
A lot of the Italian Westerns had international casts. So,
yeah.
So, and you can almost see that in the faces. I mean, there's something very, like an ethnic variety of faces.
That's true. And very often it went with co-production. You know, the Festival of Dollars is a co-production between West Germany, Spain, and Italy. So you have Italian actors, Spanish actors, West German actors. There were a whole series of West German Westerns made at the same time in the mid-1960s, where the Native Americans are all played by Yugoslavians, if you're following me.
Yeah.
So you can tell the Native Americans because they're Yugoslavian.
In America, they're all played by Jews, probably.
And, you know, you're quite right. There's this sort of ethnic mix. But I think, and in fact, in Once Upon a Time in the West, Claudio Cardinale, Italian, Charles Bronson, American, Henry Fonda, American, Gabriele Fazzetti, the man who plays the railroad baron, Italian, Frank Wolfe, an American actor who'd moved over after the blacklist of the early 50s to Rome and was making his living in the Italian film industry. It's quite a mix of actors. But I think it points to another thing, and that is that when these films came out, they were treated as ersatz American movies, you know, carbon copy westerns which were trying to ape Hollywood. I don't believe that. These are Italian movies. I think they're really best understood as part of Italian culture and European culture. They were originally made, well, Fistful of Dollars and For a Few Dollars More were originally made for the home audience. In the 1960s, Southern Italian audiences went to the cinema more often than any other audiences in the world outside America. Southern Italian audiences went to the cinema twice a week on average as adults. There was no television in Southern Italy in the mid-60s. So all the cultural references are for that audience. There's lots of references to Italian paintings, to Roman Catholicism. There are bells and churches and monks and cemeteries and crosses and angels and the interiors of churches and the whole iconography of Roman Catholicism. I think one difference between the Italian Western and the American Western is that in the end, the American Western is a Protestant genre based upon a Protestant view of the world in the 19th century, whereas the Italian Western is a Catholic genre, you know, at that fundamental level, not in an upfront way, but that's just the visual references.
Well, you know, because the casts were international, you know, we hear Eastwood's real voice in America when we hear the American version, but a lot of the actors are dubbed in the early Leone films, and you can tell they're dubbed. They sound like the old Hercules movies where everybody's dubbed. so that undercuts things a little bit, you know, because the dubbing is just so bad.
Well, it's interesting. You know, every Italian movie of the 60s was dubbed. It partly arises from building their major studio on the flight path of Fiumicino Airport. So planes go over all the time. They just didn't have the convention of natural sound in Italy. Everything was post-synchronized. Fellini, Visconti, Antonioni, all these films. And so the dubbing is not unusual. I think in the early Leones, because they didn't have much of a budget, the dubbing isn't very good. But I think the sound design of these films does have a quality of its own. The gunshots sound like cannons, and the cannons sound like nuclear explosions. Everything's pumped up on the soundtrack, and Leone once said to me that sound is 40%, at least, of the experience of a film. And that was quite new in the 60s, too. So there are pluses to the dubbing as well as minuses.
Let's talk a little bit about the music in Sergio Leone's movies. And the music was done by Ennio Morricone. And the music from the Westerns is so, it's just so good. How did Morricone and Leone had vaguely known each other in elementary school. How did they hook up as adults?
Yes, they'd known each other in the 1930s. In fact, there's a famous school photo where they're standing almost next to each other, taken in the mid-30s. But when Leone was making A Fistful of Dollars, he had to choose a composer, and he rejected the composer that the producers had suggested and went to meet Morricone. He'd forgotten they were at school together. But they talked, and they concocted a kind of anti-Western score, you know, that whereas the traditional Hollywood Western had a very symphonic, rich score, school of Aaron Copland or Jerome Moros, you know, folk tunes reworked as symphonies, they wanted something that was much more hip, much more related to pop. So you get a Fender Stratocaster guitar, as used by the Beach Boys or the Shadows. You get whistling, which is associated with kind of solitude in the desert. You get a lot of Italian folk instruments, the maranzano or jew's harp, you know, doing, 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 and a thing called the argillophone, which is a ceramic instrument with holes in it, where you get doo, that sort of thing. So it's Italian folk instruments plus rock music of the mid-1960s, and it was an astonishingly raucous, noisy sound, which became a huge bestseller as a soundtrack album, Fistful of Dollars. And it's nearer Tarantino than Aaron Copland, you know. It's kind of, it's like a pop music sampler. In fact, when I went to see Kill Bill, Part 1, Tarantino's movie, I thought he'd stolen my record collection. The soundtrack was absolutely those kind of thing. But it's raucous, it's youthful, and it's not hooked into the classical tradition at all. And it works, it's also a lot of sense of humour. It punctuates the action in a very amusing way sometimes.
And on the soundtracks of the movies and the actual movies, gunshots are used as if they're part of the score.
Yes. In fact, concrete sounds, you know, it was very trendy in the mid-1960s to experiment with music in the spirit of John Cage, the composer. And John Cage famously wrote a piece of music that consisted of silence. And the idea was the pianist would come in, sit down at his piano, and there'd be silence, and the sounds of the concert hall would become the concert. So the coughing and the rustling and the sweets being eaten in the bag and the shuffling of feet and the rustling of the programme become the music. So all sound is music. This was a very fashionable idea in the mid-60s. And they picked up on this for the Italian Westerns. Morricone was very interested in fact, he'd been to a seminar with John Cage in the late 50s. So gunshots and whip cracks and bells and choirs singing incomprehensible lyrics. Mm-hmm. I asked the choir master about the soundtrack of Fistful of Dollars. I said, what are you actually singing? You know, what is it? Is it Quick Get Back or We Must Fight? Or he said, I can't remember. It was just incomprehensible. They're just sounds, you know. And the human voice is used as another musical instrument rather than as a vocal line. So you get a lot of humming in these films. And it's interesting. It's sort of avant-garde music meets pop. And they're classic soundtracks. And they're a very important element in these films.
Christopher Frayling, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Christopher Frayling speaking with Terry Gross in 2005. He co-curated an exhibit on Sergio Leone last year. Let's hear the music they were just discussing. Here's the theme from A Fistful of Dollars. Thank you. Coming up, I discuss two new TV shows, the kind the broadcast networks used to make. This is Fresh Air. At this point in the show, I'd like to take the time to talk about two new TV offerings from genres that aren't represented that much on television these days. One's a serious discussion show. The other is an old-fashioned, large-scale Western. If the broadcast networks want to know why they're losing audience and prestige, all they have to do is look around to cable TV and PBS, which is doing what the networks used to do and doing it very well. This coming season, there isn't a single movie night on any of the broadcast networks. They've basically given up on movies and miniseries, two genres they used to own. As for the serious discussion show, well, Nightline hasn't been the same since Ted Koppel stepped down and the show went to multiple hosts and topics. In primetime, the rare one-hour interviews tend to go to tabloid-worthy celebrities, like Matt Lauer's recent Dateline NBC chat with Britney Spears. It didn't used to be that way. Less than two decades ago, the broadcast networks made great miniseries. One of the very best of them was Lonesome Dove, a CBS Western starring Robert Duvall in one of his all-time greatest performances. Duvall recently had an idea for a new Western miniseries. But the result, a very engrossing drama called Broken Trail, isn't ending up on CBS. It's premiering Sunday and Monday night on American Movie Classics on cable. Duvall co-stars with Thomas Hayden Church from Sideways. They both play cowboys, but they start Broken Trail at very different places. Church plays Hart, an itinerant cowhand. Duvall plays Hart's uncle, Print, who tracks him down to deliver the bad news that Hart's mother has died and left the ranch not to her son, but to her brother, to him. Print has an idea, though, one that requires Hart's help. A scheme to gather a lot of horses and run them from Oregon to Wyoming, where they'll fetch much higher prices.
And I'm thinking tough, high desert Mustangs. They can go unshod and ought to be fairly broke by the time we get to Sheridan.
On shares?
I figure $25.75 split on profits after expenses and loan repayment.
Loan repayment?
To the bank. I'd have to put the ranch up as collateral.
Well, what the kind of deal is that? You take the family ranch to borrow money to buy horses?
Well, that's one way of looking at it.
What's the other?
Well, you can stay here, cutting the nuts off another man's cows for chucking wages till you're all stove up and walking around like a crab, like all the other bachelor cowhands from here to the Dales. No disrespect meant. Truth is, you're as loose as ashes in the wind.
The performances are wonderful, and so are the scenery and livestock, captured in all their majesty by director Walter Hill. Hill, by the way, directed the pilot of HBO's Deadwood. And there's a fascinating subplot, too, when the cowboys pick up some unexpected companions. Five young Chinese girls, who speak only Mandarin and are being sold as slaves until Print and Hart rescue them. Broken Trail isn't quite as gorgeous or as perfect as Lonesome Dove, but it's close. And that's high praise indeed. And tonight, over on public television, Bill Moyers returns to PBS with a new series. It's called Bill Moyers on Faith and Reason, and is the first of 7 hours devoted to conversations with writers. Conversations about passion versus intellect, religion versus atheism, the clashes of international cultures, and so on. Moyers corralled the writers, who include Margaret Atwood and Mary Gordon, when they visited New York in April to speak at the Penn World Voices Festival. Some of the episodes will feature more than one author, but tonight's premiere is given over entirely to Salman Rushdie, author of The Satanic Verses and former target of a fatwa. The topics covered are somewhat predictable, but the tone is not. Rushdie is surprisingly entertaining and candid. Even when talking about such serious subjects as the violent international reaction by some Muslims to the publication of Danish political cartoons featuring the image of Muhammad, Rushdie sees some humor and even makes Moyers laugh.
I've never seen a political cartoon that didn't insult somebody.
Right.
Some of the Muslim critics said, well, how about if they were being rude about the Pope? People are routinely rude about the Pope. You know, so everyone else has got used to the fact that this is how this particular form works. Satirical political cartooning is what it is. And I think, you know, my view is people have to just learn to deal with it.
Yeah, believers need to understand, don't they, that their belief system is intact no matter what other people
exactly.
think about it.
What kind of a God is it that's upset by a cartoon in Danish?
Other topics include the First Amendment, atheism, and the best response to an act of terrorism. They do not, thank goodness, include such Britney-worthy topics as car seats, pregnancies, and music videos. Robert Duvall and Bill Moyers are old dogs, still doing their old tricks, but doing them very well. If the broadcast networks don't want them, that's their loss. If cable and public TV do, that's our gain. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Stuart, A Life Backwards, the biography of the unlikely friendship between a homeless man and the author, Alexander Masters. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Woody Harrelson, Lindsay Lohan, and Meryl Streep, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with actor Brian Cox about his upcoming role in the HBO series Deadwood. Also, we meet Dr. Paul Epstein, who tells us about the link between global warming and infectious illness. Join us for the next Fresh Air.